We come to Nahum chapter 2. God confirms his promise to judge the oppressors. Please be reminded of what we have learned thus far. Nahum prophesied around the year 650 BC, around 650 years before the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. Of the two nations, Ephraim, or also known as Israel, because more of the tribes were in that nation, and the southern nation of Judah, of the two nations of Ephraim and Judah, Ephraim had already been attacked by the Assyrians. And that was in the year 722 BC. The people of Israel were taken to other parts of the empire and scattered, while others were brought in to replace them. So the nation of Israel was no more, leaving the southern nation of Judah. Judah itself was attacked in the year 701 BC, roughly 20 years after the northern nation had been attacked. At that time, the Assyrian king Sennacherib came down, thinking that it would be easy to destroy Israel and take the people away, just as he had done, just as his father had done earlier. But God intervened at that time by the guidance of the prophet Isaiah. Hezekiah prayed to God, and God spared the nation. Sennacherib awoke in the battlefield to see many of his troops dead, and he quickly gathered the remaining of his troops and returned to Assyria, to Nineveh. And in the temple of his idol, of his god, he was killed by his two sons. So that ended the campaign against Judah. But Assyria continued to be ruled by a series of kings who asserted power over all the surrounding nations, including over Babylon and over the Medes and the Persians, who were the people who would take over the empire in latter days. Now, in the year roughly about 650 BC, at the time when Nahum began to prophesy, before Nahum prophesied, the king of Judah, Manasseh, a bad king, was attacked by the Assyrians and taken away to Babylon. What happened was that Babylon, one of the provinces of the Assyrians, rebelled, but it was crushed by the Assyrians. And the Assyrian generals believed that Manasseh of Judah was somehow involved, and so they came down south to attack Judah and took away the king Manasseh. And perhaps to refresh your mind, you'd like to look back to 2 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 33, 2 Chronicles 33. And reading from verse 10, it says, "And the Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they would not listen. Therefore the Lord brought upon them the captains of the army of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh with hooks, bound him with bronze fetters, and carried him off to Babylon. Now when he was in affliction, he implored the Lord his God, and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers, and prayed to him, and he received his entreaty, heard his supplication, and brought him back to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God." Manasseh was converted while he was in affliction in Babylon. He prayed to God humbly, and God decided to restore him. And he returned to Jerusalem, a converted man. And he tried to introduce reforms, but it was simply too late and too little. The reforms he tried to introduce was simply too little compared to the much harm that has come through his earlier days. People everywhere were engrossed in their idolatry. and his attempts to remove the idols wasn't thorough. All those high places dedicated to the various idols remained. And Manasseh just could not undo everything. But that was the situation when Manasseh was taken away to Assyria, to Babylon by the Assyrians. The people of Judah were so shaken. I remember Judah had many people of the Lord who were still faithful to God himself. These were the people, the remnant of Israel. God had been preserving them and they had been wanting to be faithful to God. But when Manasseh was taken, the nation was conquered and became a tributary of the Assyrians. The people were so shaken. They began to wonder whether God had totally left them. They began to wonder whether there would be a future for the people of Judah. And this was when Nahum spoke. So Nahum spoke around about the year 650 BC. And in Nahum chapter 1, we saw the message, God's promise to judge the oppressors. And his message to the Jews at that time is a timeless message, a message that applies for all time, that God will judge the oppressors. And from that chapter, we learned that in a situation where the church does not seem to progress much, in the days of small things, in the days when falsehood appears to be progressing more than truth, that would be the time to firstly consider who God is. Remember the person of God. God is holy and God is powerful. Then we must secondly consider what God will do for his people. God will protect his people and deliver them out of their troubles. And thirdly, we must consider what God expects his people to be doing. And his people, under all circumstances, must continue to proclaim the good news that God reigns. And for us in the New Testament times, we must proclaim the good news of salvation in the Lord Jesus Christ and continue to worship and serve God. So that is, those are the things we have learned thus far. So God has promised to judge the oppressors. Continuing on from there, we come to Nahum chapter 2. God confirms his promise to judge the oppressors. Now God is a gracious God. He often condescends to his weak people. He condescends to his people who are weak in the faith. Many times in the Bible, God said something, and what he said should be sufficient for his people to hold on to, because our God is not that like man. God is faithful. Whatever he says, he will carry out. He will not break his own promise. But you see, people being people often find just the word of God by itself insufficient to convince them. And God sometimes swears over what he has promised. Now he cannot swear by any others because there's none greater than himself. So he swears by his own name. And so you see now, with this double assurance that God will do what he has promised, his people should rest assured. His people should be at peace. His people should not be shaken by the circumstances around them. And this is an example, yet again, of what God is doing. In chapter 1, he has promised that he will judge the oppressors. In chapter 2, he goes on to confirm what he has promised in chapter 1. And the way he confirms what he has promised is to show to us two things. Firstly, that the enemies will definitely be destroyed. And secondly, the enemies will be discredited. These two truths are related. But God deliberately spells out through the mouth of Nahum what he has promised to do. His words earlier in chapter 1 should have been sufficient. But here in chapter 2, he goes at great length to describe how the enemies will definitely be destroyed and how they will be discredited. And with this vivid description, almost detailed description, God's people should feel so assured that God will definitely deal with the enemies. And so, this chapter teaches us that God will carry out his promise to deal with enemies who oppress his people. He will ensure that those who are opposed to his people will no longer have the power to do so. And he will ensure that the boast of the enemies of God's people, who are also the enemies of God, their boast will be turned to shame. Now that we can see the overall direction of Nahum chapter 2, we come now to a closer look at the trees in the forest. Firstly, the enemies will definitely be destroyed. Verse 1 to verse 10. Now in chapter 1, the last verse, verse 15, and the last few words tell us this: "For the wicked one shall no more pass through you. He is utterly cut off." Now this is a reference to wicked Assyria. Remember, as the Assyrians in those days were really notorious for their cruelty, their extreme cruelty. The king of Assyria was known to skin his prisoners alive. And they took pride in torturing his enemies like that. And the king of Assyria was prepared to do much worse. And the king of Assyria was so proud of his achievements. And Nineveh, the capital, stood by the river Tigris. Remember the river Euphrates and Tigris in Mesopotamia? The river Tigris and the tributary. And there Nineveh was located. And the rivers were, the waters of the rivers were diverted in such a way that Nineveh was surrounded totally by water. And in fact, one canal was dug through the city itself to allow some water to get into the city so that the city had plentiful water. And it was surrounded by water, which gave it such a beauty and such an awesome, splendid look from a distance that everyone admired that city. And that city looked so formidable, impregnable. Nobody seemed to be able to get through to that city. And here, continuing with what has been proclaimed about the fall of Nineveh, in chapter 2, Nahum says, "He who scatters has come up before your face. Mend the fort, watch the road, strengthen your flanks, fortify your power mightily." Now this is a taunt to the Assyrians. Now, there will come those who are opposed against you. And you think you're so powerful at this time. Nobody can conquer you. But there will come a group of people who will be more powerful than you. And much as you fortify yourself, much as you quickly try and defend yourself, you will be no match. So here is a taunt to the Assyrians. Go on! Go! Strengthen yourself! Bring out your latest weapons! You will be no match for these people who will scatter you. And that will be the first effect. These are people who will scatter, whereas you gather and you think you are strong. But God is going to allow this group of other people who will come and attack. Now with the subsequent development of history and with the unfolding of scriptures, we know that the reference is actually to Babylon. Babylon at this time was a province of the Assyrians. But the Babylonians later rose to such power that it was able to overcome the Assyrians. And from secular history, we know how it happened. What happened was that the Assyrians were so powerful and so complacent that one day the flood waters ate away one part of the walls of the city, and that part of the walls collapsed. And everything would have been all right if they had time to quickly repair the place. But what happened was that in the city were those who were unhappy with their own government. So some of them went quickly to inform the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians. They know that all these people were unhappy and planning and plotting against Assyria. And they quickly gathered a combined force. The Babylonians together with the Medes and Persians came and rushed there. And through that breach in the wall, they went in and attacked and destroyed. And that was how Nineveh fell. And Nineveh fell in the year 612 BC. And it never was rebuilt again. It never came to power again. Right up to today, it is only an archaeological site. Between that time in 612 BC and the present time, no attempt had been made to rebuild that city. It was simply destroyed so thoroughly that nobody had the heart to want to rebuild it. Now back to this passage. Nahum is prophesying that a powerful enemy will come and destroy you. And note, this enemy has come by the will of God, moved by God's decree, God's power. You see, look at verse 2. For the Lord will restore the excellence of Jacob like the excellence of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and ruined their vine branches. Now, why is the Lord, Jehovah, going to allow these powerful enemies to destroy the Assyrians? The reason given in verse 2 is that he wants Assyria to be destroyed so that the people of God, the Jews, will be able to be at peace again and to rebuild and to become splendid, glorious, like what they were before. So that is what is being prophesied. That is God's purpose. And see, Nehemiah is saying, look, at this present time, God's people are like nothing in the eyes of the world compared to their earlier days of glory. And remember, the Jews reached the peak of their glory in the days of Solomon. The nation was so powerful and so glorious and so prosperous. Everyone in the world were very respectful of the nation and came to seek the wisdom and the riches and the trade there. They came seeking to be friends of the people of Israel. And since that time, the nation had declined and declined. It split into two. And then it declined spiritually. And when it declined spiritually, it declined morally. And when it declined spiritually and morally, it became weak from within. And when it became weak from within, soon it began to crumble. And now the northern nation has been taken away. And now the southern nation has been attacked. Its king has been taken away. The nation is shaking, humble, became reduced to mere nothing compared to its former glory. And all the riches of the temples were taken away. So the Assyrians had come to empty the nation of their pride, of their glory, of their material wealth. So the nation of Israel and Judah were often represented by the vine, the grape tree. The grape tree symbolizes God's people being blessed with abundance. It was a nation flowing with honey and milk, and the symbol of the fig tree was a symbol of God's provision. The symbol of the vine is a symbol of more than your share of your material goods. You're able to drink wine over on top of your food. And so when Joshua and Caleb, together with the other spies, went to spy out the land for the first time, what did they carry back? It was a big bunch of the grapes of Canaan. So this is a picture of abundance of blessing from God. But what has become of the people of God at this time? Everything good about them had been emptied by the Assyrians. And God is going to allow the Babylonians to come and scatter the Assyrians. And it is made known at this time that these Assyrians had emptied the people of God, the Israelites, the Jews. And that is significant because later we are going to learn that the Babylonians are going to empty Nineveh terribly. Okay? Now, we move on. You see now that basically what is being said is that another nation and its allies will come swiftly, powerfully, in such a way as to cause much terror to the people of Assyria themselves. Verse 3 and verse 4 give us a graphic description of the enemies coming to attack the people of Nineveh. Verse 3 shows us that the shields of these men are made red. Now, in those days, up to until very recently, many armies in the world wore red. Now, I do not know the exact reasons, but all these years I've taken that the reason is, firstly, it appears frightening to the enemies they are fighting when they see this army wearing red coming. And secondly, when any one of them is wounded and blood flows, it wouldn't affect the person so much compared to those who do not wear it and the blood is red and it affects the victim that is suffering and it affects the morale of the fellow soldiers, and the enemies gain encouragement and would tend to attack more fiercely. So until very recent years, many armies in the world were complete red. And here is a picture of those enemies who would come and attack Assyria. Now these are the enemies of the Assyrians, namely the Babylonians with their allies, the Medes and the Persians. They were complete red and they were valiant men in scarlet. So that is a repetition of what they appear like. And then their chariots also, they use metal that is coated with copper. And so as they came with their shield also coated with copper, their shield shone and glittered in the sun as though it was also a dull red. And you see now as they brandish their spears and come in their chariots in such rage, they appear to jostle one another, which means that they are so closely packed together that they seem to be coming in a column and there is no gap in between. In other words, you cannot escape. They're coming. And look, they seem like torches. They run like lightning. So this is a description of the fearsome enemies who would come to attack the Assyrians. Now look at Assyria. Look at his king. His king sees the enemy coming. And what can he do? He can rely only on his generals. He can rely only on his warriors. Will they do something now? And look, as he look at them, as he sees this mighty man of his trying to scramble to all the places of defense, he sees them panicking, stumbling, unlike before. Verse 5. And they make haste to defend the city, but it is not going to be of any use. And look at what will happen. Verse 6. The gates of the rivers are open and the palace is dissolved. Now, because Nineveh sat on a high place, on artificial hills as well as natural hills, cut out to build the city, and it was surrounded by the waters of the river Tigris and the tributaries, it really looked strong and powerful and magnificent. If you just look at the city from the point of aesthetics, you say it's so beautiful. And if you look at it from the military point of view, you say it's impregnable. You cannot penetrate through that city. What happened is that that same city will be destroyed and reduced to nothing. And the picture used is that just as you take pride in the waters that surround you, that just as you take protection in having this moat around you, that same water will rush into your gates and just dissolve away everything. Okay? And verse 7 says, it is decreed. And when it is decreed by God, it means that you really cannot ever change God's plan. Nothing can stop this from happening because it is decreed. And we are told, she shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up. In other words, all the people in the city will not be able to fight. They will be conquered. They will be taken away prisoners. And look, Nineveh, you have prided yourself as a beautiful city. And you will be reduced to shame, very much like a beautiful maiden, a beautiful mistress that has many mates around you, serving you. Now, when you die, you have been taken out in your coffin, and you are being mourned over by these mates. And that is a picture given of Nineveh. It is like a mistress that has died and is being mourned by the many mates accompanying the funeral procession. That is what will happen to you. So verse 1 to verse 7 shows to us that God has decreed that the Assyrians will be conquered. If God has decreed it, it means that it will definitely take place. So the Assyrians will definitely be conquered. Now verse 8 to verse 10 goes on to describe the ruin, the destruction to the capital of Assyria, namely Nineveh. Now verse 8 speaks of Nineveh as though it has already been destroyed. So certain is the conquest of Assyria, and so certain is the fall of Nineveh, that you can take it that it is done already. Because if God has said it, God has decreed it, it will be done. So Nahum takes it that it is done. In this vision, in this revelation, he talks as though Nineveh is past. You see, Nineveh has been destroyed. The Nineveh of old was like a pool of water. Now they flee away. Using the picture of water again, the illusion of water that gave it such beauty and such protection. See, the uniqueness of the city with the waters around that made it so amazing to the sight. See, now that same water is now used to represent the strength and the beauty of the city. It is used to represent the people of the city. They will be scattered. They will flee. They will scatter. They are everywhere in panic. Now imagine a situation where we enter the streets of Nineveh in the days when it was still standing. And as we enter, we see smiling faces everywhere and busy people walking about everywhere in a relaxed manner, carrying all their shopping bags. See? And by the sides of the many streets will be all these brightly lit stalls and people calling out their wares. And they will be bargaining. People will be bargaining. And these big sellers will be calling out, come to me. This is very cheap. Very cheap. Come. Come and buy. Imagine that. And here you're fascinated by this man who seems to be attracting quite a lot of potential customers. You gather around with them to listen to and see what is being sold and what is being said. But suddenly, panic strikes the people. People begin to run helter-skelter. And you begin to wonder, what's happening? I better run as well, otherwise danger will come to me. And just think, this is this man who earlier had so many people listening to him. He tries to stop people. Stop! Stop! You see, don't panic! It's only a false alarm. But people would not listen. They will continue running. Now, imagine this spreads through the whole city. And the danger is not a false alarm. The danger is real. The danger is coming from the Babylonians who have attacked. And people are being slaughtered. They are being killed. And so everyone is running helter-skelter and trying to get out of the city as fast as they can. And if not, they will be killed and those alive will be taken captive. And that is the picture given to us, that the pride of the city will be reduced to nothing. The people who appear to be so contented and so prosperous and so happy with their situation, they will be disrupted in the midst of their contentment, to the point that there will be such panic that they will run everywhere. And as the enemies conquer and catch all these people who are alive and kill others, they begin to loot. And it is known from history that when the Babylonians carted away the treasures of Nineveh, nobody had ever seen so much gold and silver. Big chunks of silver utensils and silver and gold pillars and various things of gold and silver were just carted out. And it was commented that no city had such unparalleled amount of silver and gold. There was never a city the peril of Nineveh. Nineveh really was stored with so much riches. But when the Babylonians came, they emptied the city and carted all this away. Now you think back of what has been said earlier. What Assyria had done to the people of God. They had emptied the people of their glory, of their strength, see, of their treasures in the temples. And now the prophecy is they themselves will be emptied by their enemies, the Babylonians. So you see now, the peace of the city, the strength of the city, namely the people there, they will be scattered, killed, and captured. As far as the material wealth of the city is concerned, they will all be taken away. And what is the effect? Verse 10, she is empty, desolate, waste. The heart melts, the knees shake, much pain is in every sight, and all their faces are drained of color. Now it is not a pleasant sight to imagine people in pain and also panicking. See, it's never a pleasant sight to see people suffer. And here the description is given of the utter destruction of Nineveh. So the Assyrians will definitely be conquered, and Nineveh, the pride of the Assyrians, the capital of the Assyrians, will totally be destroyed. That is how the enemies of God's people, the Assyrians, will be destroyed. Covering verse 1 to verse 10. Now, you thought that is sufficient to confirm the faith of the Jews, and we should trust now in God that He will really do it. But God is not finished. The Assyrians will be discredited. Verse 11 to verse 13. The reason is because all this while the Assyrians were looked up to as a mighty power, and Nineveh was looked up to as a model city. Even the Egyptian Noamon was destroyed, and Nineveh now was the sole superpower and the sole beauty at that time. And there was no challenge from anywhere. And so, who is the oracle? It's the Assyrians. Who do you consult? It's the Assyrians. Who would you model your city after? It's Nineveh.
So where would you get all the craftsmen and all the expertise? Nineveh. They set the standards. Today, if we have the standards set, all cities must be of this size. See? And all the world has to follow. And if you set a certain measurement, all the world must follow. You set any rule concerning any trading practice, all the world must follow. Otherwise, there will be chaos. So that is to facilitate trade and ease of communication and also for the good of everyone. But who sets it? The one whom everyone respects. The one who is first. The one who is powerful. See? Because they are first, they are good, they are powerful. Everyone looks up to that nation. Everyone looks up to that group of people. Everyone respects them. See? But you see, when you are naturally good and show forth your goodness in your character, sharing forth your help, your wealth to those in need, people appreciate that very much. People will willingly want to submit themselves to you and imitate you and learn from you. But when you begin to flaunt your wealth and you become proud about your achievement and you become oppressive in your power, then people will harbor hatred against you. And although they submit to you, but they look at you with such a look that you know they submit unwillingly. There is resentment and hatred and jealousy in them. That is what happens with the Assyrians. They flaunted their strength, their power, their beauty, everything good about them. They took too much pride in themselves and looked down upon others and went around oppressing others. You see? Look at verse 11. You prided yourself as a strong and safe place, almost like a lion's den. You have all these young lions everywhere guarding you. In other words, you have all these young men who are warriors everywhere, whom you have trained up, so that at a call only, they will come. Troop after troop will come out of that den. So everyone is afraid of you because of your military might. And look, you have trade and industries, and you are so prosperous that you have so much to eat. And all your wealth comes from attacking and plundering others like lions. Verse 12. See? Now, speaking plainly, the Lord is against you. Verse 13. He will come and break your military power. He will stop you from plundering others. He will take away your rule over all the other provinces. When we are told that their chariots will be burned and the young lions, that is their warriors, will be killed, we know that their military might will be broken. When we are told that they will no longer be able to prey on others, it means that they will have no ability anymore to oppress other nations. When we are told that their messengers will no more be traveling to all the provinces to declare their wish of the king, it means that they will no longer be ruling over all these provinces. So, Assyria, who had been feared, who had been looked up upon to by others, who had imposed themselves on others, they have been too much. They have gone too far. They have flaunted their wealth. They have flaunted their power. They have flaunted their influence over others. And therefore, instead of just describing the city and the nation being conquered and destroyed, God is saying that they will be discredited. You think they are so powerful? They are actually reduced to nothing in power. You think they are so full of intelligence, full of wisdom, it will be shown that they are nothing in terms of their intelligence and wisdom. You think they are so rich with all the material wealth, you discover that they are just empty. There's nothing in them. So you see now, everything that people looked up to and admired about Assyria, everything that they had been in awe about Nineveh, will be reduced to nothing. So the message to Nahum is not only that the nation will be conquered and Nineveh will be destroyed, but also everything that you can look up to, that you can say good about, will be shown to be nothing. You see now, the enemies will be discredited, verse 11 to verse 13. Just as the enemies will definitely be destroyed, verse 1 to verse 10. That is Nahum's message in chapter 2. To confirm the fact that God will fulfill his promise to destroy the oppressors of his people. Now how does that truth translate to us today? God is still the same God. He's still the faithful God. And he will never break his promise to his people. And he has still his people today. And if anything, he has affirmed his love to those who are chosen by him, who are called out of this world, who have come to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And the Lord Jesus Christ himself said, even the gates of Hades cannot prevail against his church. His kingdom will grow. The gospel will spread. Souls will be saved. And there will be none who can pluck anyone of the chosen people of God from the hand of their God. And all these are promises that are applicable right up to today and will be applicable right up to the time when Jesus Christ returns to judge the world. If you understand this, then you will understand also the principles taught in Nahum, that God will judge the oppressors of his people, and God confirms that he will break the power of those who oppose his people, hinder the cause of the gospel, and oppress the church. And that is for sure. Now let us consider some recent examples. Communism at one stage was much feared. It was looked upon as though it is a mighty power. And the people who were living under the communist regimes suffered for their faith. Yes, it was only not too long ago before that big structure fell, before communism collapsed, before it was reduced to nothing and is totally discredited. So, are you afraid of the communists now? Not like before. The communists are not a power today. No nation in their right mind would want to adopt communism today. You say, oh, China is still holding on to communism. But it's not the same. The communism in China today is changing. It's hardly communism at all. And furthermore, the none is known to advocate the hardline communism of the past. And look at the masses in China. You think that they want that sort of hardline, full-blooded communism of the past? None of them want that. Today they're moving more and more away from what we know to be communism. So what I'm saying is, you see, in our own lifetime, the fall of that much feared system known as communism. Now, consider next, evolution and other false sciences and philosophies. It's creating havoc. It seems to have had a hold on so many minds in the world. So many people just assume that evolution is right. And therefore they find great difficulty believing in creation as taught in the Bible. And the Christian church is fighting such a battle to win the mind of the masses, to prevent them from being drawn away by evolution. See? But we must remember the truth taught in Nahum, that God will definitely destroy the enemies of his people, and he will discredit them. Evolution appears so respectable. So many scientists in the world, respectable scientists, appear to be advocating that. And this is taught in universities, and it is honored everywhere. People tend to think that evolution is so respectable, so scientific. And if you have any contrary view, you are the underdog. You are the one who is laughed at. People laugh at you. People sneer at you. You at this time still holding on to creation. Now that is the situation we are faced with. But God is assuring his people that even evolution or any other false sciences, any other philosophies will be brought down, and its power, their power will be broken, and they will be discredited. Just wait and watch. Today, terrorism frightens people all over the world, and it's so destructive. And look, Christians are actually targeted. It's not just the nominal Christian states, but Christians are actually suffering. Look at just the neighboring country of Indonesia. Just very recently, 3 Christian ladies have their heads chopped off in one part of Indonesia. Have you not heard? Have you not known? And many pastors are being tortured. Churches are forced to close down. It is happening now. And much as the authorities try to prevent the news of this spreading around, we know that it is happening. And Christians continue to labor for the Lord, to preach the gospel, despite so much threat and so much danger to themselves. Now what can we say to Christians in nations like this? We must remind them that God is really with his people, and he has promised to destroy the oppressors of his people. And not only will he destroy them, but he will discredit them. One day, false religions and all the wickedness in those who try to hinder the cause of the gospel and attack God's people, they will be seen to be really so despicable. People will shun them. People will not want to have anything to do with them. What is portrayed as so respectable, you see, and is challenging others, you see, will be reduced to nothing and will be avoided by people. So think, it will be reduced to nothing, it will be avoided by others. God is not interested in only telling us that he will destroy, but he will discredit them. And that is our comfort. Meanwhile, what do? We come back to the last point in chapter 1. God's people must be in God's vineyard, doing the work that has been assigned us. Although we live in the days of small things, we must go on faithfully, trusting in the Lord, and labor on. And as we labor for him, his Spirit is at work in us to accomplish God's plan. And the day will come when those who attempt to hinder and to attack God's people and God's cause, God will remove them. God will discredit them. Let us not be too agitated by the power of evil that is portraying themselves in the garb of good. We must not be too uptight over them. Our battles often must be fought on the ground. We must not attempt what is beyond our duty to do. What is important is that we faithfully go on in the difficult situation. And we know that the Lord is with his people. Why? Because he has promised so. Remember the Great Commission? It ends with, "And lo, I shall be with you to the end of the age." Has not the Lord promised that? And of course he has. That is why we will continue to proclaim the good news and to draw win souls to Jesus Christ, to build up the Church of Jesus Christ, to be used by him in his work while it is day. Let us trust in our sovereign God. Let us trust in our faithful God. Let us trust in what God has promised to us, that he will never leave us nor forsake us. He will vindicate us. Let God be the one who avenges his people. We continue to trust him and to labor for him faithfully. And God will see to it that we will be preserved, that his kingdom will extend, that his church will be built up. May that take place. May that take place. May that take place even in our lifetime.